Hello to you. This is In Real Life, brought to you by the Big Picture Film Club, a platform for independent films and original stories. Here, we learn about our guests through the medium of film and television. This week's guest is the godmother of British comedy, making a name for herself in setting up the Jongleurs Comedy Club empire, and was awarded an MBE for her services to entertainment and hospitality. She is also qualified as a psychotherapist and is a life coach and mentor and contributes to a plethora of charities close to her heart. A very jolly welcome to you, Maria Kempinska.
Jules, I'm so pleased to meet you. And I don't know if you know, Jules is about to have a baby. So I'm even more pleased that we're here.
I know, thank you so much for making it before I drop. Yeah. So Maria, you are of Polish descent. How much of an influence has your heritage had on you and growing up and in your career?
Well, it was interesting because at home we spoke Polish. We were the only Polish family on our council estate. And
so is it your mother tongue?
Yeah, Polish? my first language was Polish. Wow. However, of course, they didn't recognise second languages in schools at that time and insisted that my mother only spoke English to us at home. But outside, we were English. So we had this sort of dichotomy of which language do I speak? So when my friends used to come round, it was part Polish, part English. And one of my friends actually picked me up from one Saturday evening, and he was wearing a cravat. We were going to a party. He was very super, in a souped-up sports car, came onto the estate, and he came into my house to pick me up. And my mother said, so where are you going? And he said, we're going to a party. And she said, well, have a lovely time. And she had a great Polish accent. And he said, we will, super duper. And duper in Polish is backside.
Oh, goodness.
I know. And my mother was in hysterics laughing, as I knew.
Oh, and she didn't take it the wrong way.
No, she just thought it was so funny that he was saying super duper. And that means something totally different. And from that basis, you know, sort of humour was a big thing for, you know, particularly your mother. I think a mother's humour has a big influence in a child's life, actually.
That was my next question. Did you find comedy or did comedy find you?
I think a bit of both, in a way. I think, you know, sort of my parents were both political refugees. They were both prisoners of war. They came over they joined the Free Army. Well, the Free Army took them, if you like, in 1941 when they were freed from Siberia. They joined the British Army in North Africa and came over to Egypt, so Iran, Iraq, Egypt, and then up to Monte Cassino. So they both fought there and then came over to the UK. So their story was so harrowing because they'd lost everybody and everything and their whole future. My mother was a mathematician. My father was training to be a barrister and their whole lives had been ripped apart. Their families, everything, and they saw death and they saw destruction and they saw murder. And just all the horrors of both the Nazis and the Russians and how they impacted on Poland.
So they were very much refugees.
Oh, they were, in every sense of the word. So when we were brought up, there were six of us in one room.
Wow.
So we didn't have a great deal of money. And my mother was always, you know, in despair and how she's going to feed us. But she was a devout Catholic. And so was my father. But that was very much part of my upbringing, listening to my mother's story and my father's story, and then being introduced to the lifestyle in the UK and the fun, actually. England's second language is humour, but there it is again in Poland. So I've had times when I've sat around a table with friends when we have a Polish waiter, and if a Polish waiter starts telling a joke, I would translate it for my friends. And it would just be mad and fun, just that experience. I mean, my Polish isn't the best. We didn't go to Polish school. But it's a big, big part of my life because of their journey, what happened to them. So if ever I fall on bad times, I think it's never as bad as theirs. Never in a million years is it as bad as theirs. So I'm always blessed and lucky that my parents did everything to make sure we were okay. And my father took time out to teach us, as my mother did. My mother ended up making Christmas crackers, so we'd get those stupid jokes from Christmas crackers.
Wow.
Which were, you know, they are so stupid, but funny.
She made them.
Yeah, so we used to all make that. This was our in-house industry, you know, for extra money and things. So I was working from the age of 11, which never occurred to me not to. So, you know, sort of all that. And when people talk about what kids are capable of, children are capable of so much. They're so amazing.
Yeah.
If they realize there's a meaning for them. It's what is the meaning of your life? Does, you know, if your parents don't have any money and they spend it on drugs, sex, rock and roll, kids know that. Mm. Kids know it's not anything about them. They know that they're being neglected, or they know that the parents are doing everything they can and they want to help. Mm. We should never take that away from children. And I think if they get mixed messages and they grow up like that, you know, so there's being confused in the world and what is really going on here.
And I can see that you very much see what you went through as a child and working since 11 and seeing your parents work and hearing about what they had come from. I can see that you see that very much as a gift rather than any kind of disadvantage in comparison to the children that you may perhaps have grown up around and the gifts that that has given you and the drive it's given you and on the opportunity essentially it's given you on balance growing up and being able to see both sides of the coin. And it is fair to say that that can be quite lacking in today's
society. I think it's not taught. You know, when I do therapy with people, I look for something that's called personal genius, so that everybody grows up with two sides to them in a way. It's who are we when we come into the world? You know, Wordsworth said, our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting, and we come in with something. The Greeks called it your personal, you know, your daemon. Who are you inherently that's separate from the family? But then you've got your family impacting on you, and your family's job in a way, like the petals of a flower, is to protect you in some way. And that, of course, it doesn't happen in a way. That's what life's about. This is our spiritual, not only our spiritual but a physical journey, and we are given challenges. And if we understand it as a journey, like the Greeks did in their mythology or the Romans, and you go, well, what's my story? Who am I? What have I been given? What's my hand that I've been given to deal with in my life?
And how am I going to overcome these hurdles that come towards me in the gauntlet that is my life?
Yeah, and I think if people understand that potentially this challenge is a spiritual challenge, that you are going to learn something so deep and profound that will affect the rest of the world, you'll see it differently.
Yeah, and receive it as a gift.
And receive it in a different way, and be able to deal with the struggle, the internal struggle. Let's not get away from the internal struggle that people go through, because very often people are given help, they're given handouts, they're given, you know, sort of housing and things, but that's not the biggest struggle anymore. It's how do you deal with the lack of your future? This is where I thought my future was going, and this is where I am. You know, how do you deal with that? And somebody to help you, somebody to guide you, that signpost or the lighthouse in the storm. And I think that's what we're lacking. And the society's sort of, all the structures are breaking down. You know, the trust of politicians, the trust of media, if you like. The people in power actually don't realise what power means. And people love it and they want it and they go out for power, whether it's the power of being a director on a film or TV or the newspaper or a politician. People have that power, or in business, and yet they don't understand the value of that. And it's sacred, that power, because you should use it wisely, and people don't. They're very indulgent. And they go, it's me. No, it's not you, actually. It's what you do with it. And if you can understand that, and you must have a bit of humility. And that's why I like the idea of a God, whichever God you believe in, that somebody that you revere that's greater than you.
A higher power,
That says, that challenges you and questions, that you can question yourself, because in this world, people often think money's everything, and it's not. You know, it can take you on dangerous courses and make you deal with people in a very poisonous or destructive manner.
We can see for ourselves what's happened with, you know, a lot of people who've got a lot of money very quickly, for example.
And you know, it's what's in the wake of that. You know, what do we do with the people that are left, that can't fend for themselves, that don't understand? You know, it's actually bearing that in mind. And I think a lot of people just don't think about that. It's all about me.
Now, we are here to talk about film with you. I would like to start with Polish film and television, which is probably sort of less known about here in the UK. Could you tell us about Polish film and television and what it's like?
Well, I can only tell you a little bit, because Polish film wasn't really brought over here. So I didn't grow up with Polish film and television. And my parents used to love, you know, sort of it was the standard BBC stuff, BBC ITV. And I've only really got into Polish film recently. Okay. But I was involved in making the Polish Odyssey, which was the story of prisoners of war in Siberia. And I was a producer on that.
Wow.
So that was such an amazing film, actually. And
how did you get involved in that?
The woman who made it, one of the women who made it, was a parent at my kid's school.
Okay.
Yeah, so
it serendipitous.
The whole thing was serendipitous. And sadly, both of the women are now no longer alive. Because when you make a film, this is what people perhaps don't realise who watch films. Not only making it, do people put their heart and soul into it. It has to take a part of you, your film does, especially on that level. And it did with the women. And I think that it didn't have the impact that they wanted. That's not their fault. I think that many people that didn't understand what was happening during the war were blaming the Poles for, you know, sort of what the Nazis did. Some people, even Stephen Fry, made this big mistake, which he had to apologise for, because Auschwitz was in Poland. He said it was a Polish concentration camp, and it wasn't. It was a Nazi camp.
Of course.
Do you see what I mean? Yeah, but you get people, that's what I mean. Understand your power. You know, so when somebody like Stephen says that, they don't hear the apology, they hear the statement. Mm. You know, so with comedians, if they ever tackle anything historic, you've got to know your history and come from it at a slant that has truth to it. Otherwise, you're being, you know, you're just delivering propaganda. Mm. And I think the women took a lot of flack from certain people, and I think that really harmed them and injured them in a big way, because it was almost making what was a documentary into a fable. People were saying that's not true.
Why specifically the women?
They were the ones that made it.
Okay.
They were both the director. They filmed it and they produced it.
I see,
it.
Yeah. I see. So it was pretty much an all-female production.
Thing, yeah, right. Mostly. Yeah.
And why was it all female?
I think they were both Polish and they, you know, maybe it's part of their heritage that they felt needed to be dealt with. Once this film was made, this might give you an insight. I spoke to a social worker from Manchester. He said she showed it to a group of Polish people that she was looking after in a home, maybe an old people's home. And she said, pre the film being seen to post the film, the documentary being seen, the people were visibly different, both in their mental state but also in their physical state, because it was the first time their experience had been validated and was able to be seen by others. Because over here, for example, when I was growing up, there was my parents' story and the story that was seen outside. Nobody in my community knew what had happened to the Poles. Because it was all censored, because after the war, because the agreement had been made with the Russians, what had happened to Poland wasn't recognised. So everybody thought the Nazis had done things and the Russians hadn't. Mm. So the whole story of Siberia was just hidden. And I think that's a lot to do with our history per se.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you feel that, I mean, I think in the UK, what is known about Poland and the culture is often defined, sadly, by the socio-political influences that Poland has been, you know, that have been thrusted upon Poland. And it's now sort of slightly shaking those shackles off a little bit, and people are recognising Poland as a really fun holiday destination, Krakow, and I've got friends that have gone there and said it's beautiful. And that's really great. But how do you think that all of that kind of history has influenced the TV and the media? Sorry, television and film coming
from
Poland.
Yeah, I think that when I was watching recently this film called Claire, which is about the Polish priests.
And that translates as clergy, doesn't
it? Yeah, clergy. Yeah. So, and it was interesting that they had exactly the same problems that anyone anywhere with the Catholic priests about abusing children and so on. And it was interesting their take on it, because, of course, they had a different take, slightly different. And I love international films. Actually, I love Netflix for that. I love Amazon for that, but mostly Netflix. Open the door to international films. And it gives you an opportunity to see something from a slightly different aspect, which is also their psychosocial or psychoanthropological point of view. Mm. And I love that because it has that. They also had alcoholism in there, you know, the battle between right and wrong, you know, the shame, the guilt. How
Yes, it touches on quite a lot of controversial issues within the church.
And I love that. So it's not just, oh, you know, they did that and they're bad people. You also see the struggle. And I think that psyche in the Polish psyche is one of struggle, finding right from wrong. I mean, they really have been people that have struggled for many, many years as a culture and as a society. And I think that struggle comes through and is coming through now. But let's not forget, you know, they politically are struggling. So when that film was brought out, you had the politicians over there, which are more right-wing, saying, you shouldn't be showing that, that's crazy. You know, so they have their own political struggles going on. And we can see now that being played out in the EU, that are getting, you know, Tusk is becoming very vocal about what we as Britain should be doing. And you go, that's not the Poland I know.
Yeah. So growing up for you, what was probably one of the most significant films that influenced your youth?
It has to be It's a Wonderful Life.
It's,
oh my God, I think I saw that. And I think what an amazing actor, James Stewart. Mm. But when you see it and you know that he's standing on that bridge and he's debating, do I live, do I die? Mm. You know, I'm not doing everything I have led my life to believe. I've gone down that road, I've provided, and suddenly it's all taken away.
It's that bittersweet, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and I think it sort of was very typical. I mean, it happened in my parents' life. They do everything, and yet it's taken away. And that is where another force comes into your life.
That so that's you have what nothing. Spoke out to you?
Because also the angel coming in and saying, no, you have a value, but you're not seeing it. Mm. And only when he went back home and people came in to support him did he see it. Because very often you don't see the impact you're having on the world. But it was also the potential Mr. Anybody. I am anybody and I can have an impact on the world. And I remember thinking actually as a child, you know, about the power of Hitler and people like that. My goodness, there's this one man who seemed to... I know better now that there were so many more people involved, but he was the spokesperson for the Nazis. And I used to think, if one man can do so much damage, can one person do so much good?
The opposite.
Yeah. And it's always been that, can you define that as an individual? And how do you do that? So it's how to harness your own power in a way that power has a very bad connotation to it. But I use it in, we all have power, actually. And it's how do you harness it and how do you use it for good? And what are you going to do?
Yeah, and using it shoulder to shoulder with other people rather than other people having to be in the shadow of your power, etc.
Well, I think, yes, I agree. I think if you can, but lots of people want to be in your shadow or they want to see the root, you know, but it's down to you not to diminish that. Mm. You know, it's how you view the world that is important, not so much whether somebody turns to you for advice. It's what do you do with that ability? If that's what you've been given and that's what you strive for on one level, that drive that we have in life that is over and above, you know, sort of getting money and finding a house to live in and the day-to-day stuff, am I driving my car, okay, I've got to pay for this and that. You know, what else are we here for? Mm. If you challenge and question yourself on that, you will find a power. And then it's how do you use it with other people in mind that is caring for them. But I don't mean making them into children, because that's what our state is doing. We shouldn't, you know, it's good for people to struggle at times. Mm. It's good for people to not to have everything given to them. And it's very dangerous to keep people as babies.
Mm. On that note of power, your main power was helping define the UK's stand-up comedy scene.
I know, wasn't I lucky?
And you set up the first Jongleurs Comedy Club in 1983 with a bank loan. Where did the vision for this come from? It started out as a broader entertainment venue with cabaret and music, didn't it? Yeah. And then it's sort of, you funneled it into comedy. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I went to Edinburgh. I was promoting a poet who did an hour show. In fact, I was training to be a singer-dancer at that time. So my parents couldn't afford to send me to any classes. Mm. And so I worked during the day and did the classes at night, four or five a week, and found an amazing singing teacher, Nettie Patam. And her husband was a playwright or a poet. And they said, well, this is your holiday. Will you come up to Edinburgh and promote Leo? Which I did. And as I was sort of wandering around and talking to various members of the press, I found I sort of quite engaged with them quite well. Anyway, he got, not only did he get packed houses, he got rave reviews. But when I was up there, I noticed that there were so much talent up there that we needed somewhere in London to do this. And I thought, right, I know a place. I used to go roller skating there. I thought maybe that place would be good above a pub. Approached them. I had two other people who were going to work with me. And they said yes. And it's never straightforward, this stuff. But fortunately, you know, like the fool in the tarot card, you go ahead. That sort of blind innocence. I approached the pub. They were changing hands on the day. And they said, yes, come in and do it. For them, they thought, great, we've got somebody that's going to do all this in hindsight. And for next to nothing. And they didn't have to do a great deal. But fortunately, I very quickly was getting people that were in, you know, sort of a political cabaret. So I had Pookie Snackenberger on the first night. And I had a lot of other very famous people that then weren't famous. Paul Merton, Lee Evans, you know, all these sort of people coming out. Rory Bremner, he was still at university.
Wow.
And I had set up the evening like a cabaret show. And gradually, because of health and safety, we had to stop a lot of the acts.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And so then it sort of limited us to comedy. But then comedy started growing. There were more and more comedians coming out. Mm. So my theory was, if I put on enough acts that are good, A, one of them will become a star, and B, we give everybody a chance. And then I'll do the first choice, and then the audience does the rest, basically. But we found that the pubs loved it. Yeah. And so they wanted more of this. And that's how the genre's experience grew.
That's amazing. And you've helped to launch the careers of comedy geniuses, you know, a couple that you mentioned there, but Fry and Laurie, Graham Norton, Frank Skinner, Jack D, list goes on. Who have you been most impressed by, and who do you think has made a successful transition over to television?
I think people like Paul Merton.
Mm.
You know, when you watch Paul, when he first started...
Well, he's been going for decades now.
He has.
It shows that if you stand the test of time.
But I think it's not without a lot of pressure. But he sent a tape to me when he was a student. And then he came and did an open spot and he wore pinstripe pyjamas. And he did this...
What the rationale for that?
Well, it was that he was a policeman on drugs, giving evidence in court. And he said, you know, he'd make crazy statements about, you know, being on a bus and things like that. And he was very anarchic and, you know, surreal. And it was great fun to watch him. Mm. I mean, Mike Myers performed a couple of times.
Did he?
Yeah, a number of times with two different acts there. So we had Sam Kinison down there, you know. So a lot of the top comedians came down. And, so Paul... Then he went into his more stand-up, wearing sort of suited and booted. And then his transition onto television gave him the opportunity. It gives you a bit of it cushions you a little bit, but it also gives you the opportunity to have those one-liners that he's so good at.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of changing the perspective on things. We have great comedians still out there that nobody has seen on television.
Yeah.
That, you know, sort of, although television at the moment is eating them up.
And they're lucky if they get a spot at Edinburgh and if they get seen there. But it's
well, it's
amazing,
it's to so. Do with, actually, it's always to do with the commissioner. Mm. Do they like you, do they not? And I don't think there's a big representation on television, big enough, that represents the true circuit.
On that note, women in comedy.
I know.
It's improved a bit. We've got, you know, a new generation, Aisling Bea, Sarah Millican, Catherine Tate coming through more recently, even though Catherine Tate has actually been around for a long time. Mm. But, you know, comparatively, when you look at Jo Brand and Sandy Toksvig from a very long time ago, but there's still such a huge abyss where women are just not used and just very much lacking on the panel shows we see today and all the comedy shows. How can we, I mean, what do you think is being done to rectify this, and do you think enough is being done?
Do you know, I still think that people unconsciously book people that are similar to them. Mm. So on the comedy circuit, when I was doing it, we had lots, all the women that were there that I could get hold of performed, but the good ones were snapped up to television straight away. Whether it was Hattie Hayridge or whether it was Helen Lederer, they were all just taken away. So they were less doing the live circuit and they went to television. Of course they would. The live circuit is a struggle. Mm. You know, you have to run around from one venue to another. It's full
of
guys.
It's permanently living out of a...
Yeah, and also when suitcase. You come off the stage, I did 10-minute stand-up for a charity, which was... It's a must for anybody who wants to do anything that is internally challenging, believe me.
I knew about that, yeah, and I wanted to talk to you about that.
But I thought, actually, I was offered an agent offered to represent me.
Off the back of that?
Off the back of
Wonderful.
That.
Wonderful, yeah, and?
Well, I thought, you know, A, do I want to run around to all these different venues, which
well,
you have
know
to
more
do.
Than anyone what it's like.
Yeah, and also... you have to compromise a part of yourself, I think, because there's that success point. What do you think is funny? What do you think the audience will like? And what the audience truly likes about you? And the two may not meet in the middle. So, you know, do I want to compromise my material to actually be successful? And I thought, no, I don't.
You have that insight, though, and I think a lot of, let's say, if you know, there are up-and-coming comedians who are just starting out on the stand-up circuit, they may not be aware of that compromise that they need to make, and they sort of go into it naively, which sometimes can work out really well for them if they
Absolutely.
Are completely wholeheartedly yeah. themselves and as a package received like that. Mm. That's great and good for them. But at the same time, I guess you've had so much experience behind the scenes and seeing the bigger picture that I guess all of that can be quite overwhelming to think about, you know, can be quite, you know, all consuming.
Yeah, it can. But also, I think you have to divulge part of your life on stage because it has to be the modern comedy is you
right.
Putting yourself out there. There are great women, you know, sort of Mandy Knight. That continues. Gina Yashere has gone to America. The bold and the powerful go to America. They're better recognised there. You know, Sarah Millican is great. She was the same on the circuit as she is now on television. But there's a certain attitude from the audience to people like Sarah Millican, which is...
An expectation of her being...
Yeah, she yeah. is subservient yeah. slightly. She's self-effacing.
Yeah.
And I think those women do so much better for the British psyche. Mm. And if a woman comes off stage, she doesn't get any groupies. Come on, girls. This is the biggest problem. Men do, girls don't.
Of course.
And I think,
of course,
so you come off.
There's a huge line waiting for Jack Whitehall backstage.
Totally. And women need to get those. So yeah. Men, come on, get your act together. And I think that would make a big difference. Male groupies.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, sort of, it's true, though. You come off stage and you are left quite vulnerable. It's that sort of empty space that you're not even in relation to yourself at that point because you've given so much.
So who do you think are the comic geniuses of the big screen?
Oh, my gosh.
And leading into any film, particularly comedy films.
Well, I must say, when I was asked this, actually, I know I'm going to... really upset people by saying this, but I love things like Hangover.
So Bradley Cooper and the cast specifically?
Yeah,
because
it's the four of them. It's almost like the four elements of one person.
Yeah.
You know, I remember growing up and listening to my brothers talking about their fun life and what men can do. And women, you know, go off and do it in a different way now. But, you know, sort of men always had that. Of going out and having fun, doing the most dangerous and the naughtiest things, and how life, you know, sort of things actually happen to them and how they deal with it, but they stick together, the band of brothers.
But do you like, so did you appreciate The Goons and Monty Python? And
oh my God, my favourite Spike Milligan. I loved Spike Milligan. Mm. I loved his interaction, as you say, with The Goons and everything. The Marx Brothers must have been the top, because... Again, it's the four together, the brothers, although there were five. there were four that performed, and the way that they instinctively knew each other's...
The energy bouncing off each other.
Yeah, you know, when you work closely with people, you get to know them. It's like the family. And they, when they did their live shows, they used to improvise on stage. So if they saw a cockroach on the stage, they used to all take bets to how long it would take to get to the other side of the stage and things like that.
Just
and
made it, performance.
Yeah, and the audience would go with them. And that is, I love improv.
Yeah.
And I used to teach improv when I taught English and drama, and love engaging in that. But I think, and introduced the first improv onto the circuit with Omelette Broadcasting, who were amazing. And the audience gets taken in by that, and that's what they were able to do.
That's almost an oxymoron, teaching improv.
I know. It is an oxymoron, anyway.
How do you do that?
You can create the container for it, don't you? You don't... You allow people to be more spontaneous. There's certain rules, which are you mustn't be negative.
Mm.
You know, you've got to go with it. If somebody says, as they do, you know, with the cockroach across the stage, you can't say, no, there isn't a cockroach, there's an audience here, we've got to do something else. You've got to go with it. That's it.
Yeah.
It's the rules are, let's go with it. And I think that's a great... rule of life, let's just go with it. You know, what is this going to lead me to? If somebody asks me to do something, whether it's charity or something, I'll go, I don't say, oh, I don't have time or something. I say, yes, let's go with it and see where it leads. Because sometimes life hands you, you know, sort of a gift for you to reach out to and pulls you along. And that's like the whole of improv. And then and that enables you to find your voice.
Mm.
You can't find your voice if there's always these barriers going up all the time.
What do you think about all this kind of canned, staged laughter that we have, particularly over the other side of the pond in the States, compared to the comedy that was available over here and in the States, you know, a while back?
I still think TV is a different medium.
Mm.
And it's the same with stand-up. If you put stand-up on television, it's still quite difficult to get that relationship with the audience at home. So canned laughter allows the audience at home to know this: it's okay to laugh. This is what
so
it's meant
to be. So
you
think it does have a function? And
I do think it has a function because it's a different medium. It would be weird, though, if it was in a comedy club and somebody suddenly... We should try it. Let's do the canned laughter in the comedy club and see if it works.
Let's see what happens. Yeah, absolutely.
But can I just say one of my favourite comedians, or two of them, were Sam Kinison and Bill Hicks. I love Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle, by the way. I love people who rock the boat. I think we need more of that here, and I talk to comedians about that over here.
Do you? You encourage them to really push the boundaries and hang right on the edge.
Yeah, they've got to, but I think we've become too safe.
I agree.
You know, I think it's getting a little bit tedious, and I think we've got to have that. Push the boundaries, make a statement, whether it's for or against something.
Absolutely.
But not the same as everybody else.
I couldn't agree more. It would be really satisfying and entertaining and even offer some kind of socio and political kind of commentary if we had more of that.
Definitely.
And more talking points.
You want people to stop and question. I put on a show on Saturday and I had Jeff Boyes, who's Scottish, amazing. He tells his story from his point of view. Sean Mayo, who is one of the most underrated comedians on the circuit. Peter Francis, who is normally on the urban circuit, coming in and doing something totally different. And Mark Dolan, who is an amazing host and amazing presenter. So, you know, I like to put diversity on a show and know that somebody's going to feel uncomfortable in the audience. I like to feel uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
You know, I think, you know, I paid to see Chris Rock because he's worth it. And, you know, I was sitting there with my girlfriends and one of them took umbrage from what he said. I said, but that's interesting that he said that because it was about me as well. And I thought, you're right. You've got me.
Mm.
You know, and I think we should come away from a comedy show. You've got me. Why did I feel that? Mm. And then take that away. That should be talked about at dinner parties.
It's great, isn't it, when comedians essentially shove a mirror in your face and then you can see what's reflected back at you and sometimes you don't like it.
I know. What is your mirror?
Yeah.
And for them to find that for you, doing your job in a way, great.
Yeah. So you qualified as a psychotherapist around 10 years ago. What roused that decision alongside all of your other commitments? How did you find the time to do that and why was it so important to you?
Well, I'm sure you were the same when you were growing up. It's that it's jack of all trades, master of none.
Mm.
And for all my life, people have said, Oh, stop thinking in so many different ways. Focus on one thing, in business particularly. Focus on one thing, or whether you're studying, focus on this, or you've got to be that. And I thought, actually, that isn't who I am, but how do I do it and not get discouraged by other people? And the only way I did it was not by not telling anybody, basically.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Do you know what I mean? You just keep it quiet, or just tell certain people. And I thought, I'd already been in psychotherapy myself and saw the value of that, and particularly Jungian therapy, where you deal with dreams, and I love dream work. And okay. I started, so I was I still am an avid reader. And I did a course in as an MA and did the psychological types of stand-up comedy, first of all.
That makes sense.
And then I was going to do a conference with different psychotherapists or psychoanalysts or professors on it, and met my future professor, who is Andrew Samuels, who is, he's great at arguing. He is a tour de force in the field of psychotherapy, writes everywhere, deals with major politicians, you know, the highest ranking politicians. I think he should deal with Trump and he would be good. I'm not anti-Trump totally, because I think he's like the trickster. Again, has a role to play, but I would love to see the dynamic between them. And I happened to be talking to him and he said, oh, you're in business. Oh, my God. You know, that's a terrible place to be. And I said, no, that's the perfect place to be if you want to make changes. You've got to do it from within. And I said, and, you know, sort of the Silk Road wouldn't have happened and cultures wouldn't have exchanged had merchants not gone between this, you know, from India to China and so on. And he said, you should do a PhD. And that's how he suggested I did it. So I said, right, I'm going to do this. He said, you've got to get to Exeter, Colchester. I said, don't care where I've got to go. I'm going to do this.
It's nice to have that, you know, seed of encouragement from someone who you really respect and, you know,
that is
look up to in that field.
I absolutely do look up to him. And he had no clue about stand-up comedy, but he allowed me he gave me permission to give him enough enthusiasm to prove to him that I could do this. And it's a struggle. You're on your own, you're doing it at home, and I'm quite self-motivated, so that enabled me to do it. And got through it after 7 years and wrote a piece about how stand-up comedy can help you find yourself, individuate, the Jungian term is.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Jimmy Carr is coming to mind because he also was a medic and he was a doctor. And while he was in, I think it was practicing some psychology, he also then, that's when he started, he went through a depression, which I think he talks quite openly about, and then started talking about how he would then write his thoughts down and they turned to jokes. I mean, albeit quite sick and dark jokes, but he used that to utilize comedy to kind of balance out those dark moments. And it is very interesting. I think there is a lot more to be said about the relationship between comedy and, you know, and psychology.
Well, I use humour in my therapy room when I know a client and when they know me, because I think you're absolutely right, because in the big scheme of things, in Buddhist religion, if you can call it that, or philosophy of life.
We have a laughing Buddha, don't we?
They do have the laughing, but you also have crazy wisdom, that you don't know why something's going on, but it is totally crazy. And we're almost in that life at the moment, because the world is crazy at the moment. So how do you make sense of it? But it is holding the two opposites and making sense of those. And sometimes you can only do that through humour.
It makes the paradox available, doesn't it?
And I think jokes do that. Jokes come in from a divergent point of view and take you on a new journey. And for me, my whole argument, or one of my arguments in my piece, was that the trickster, which was a character, and some people say, oh, comedians are tricksters, and you get that in, particularly in film, the trickster character. And I said, no, you know, we've moved to a point where the trickster is the joke, because it's one joke that can change your life, one point of view, one way of thinking that can do that. But coming back to Jimmy Carr and a lot of comedians, because they bear their soul on stage, it becomes a sort of therapy. And I'm setting up a centre with people who deliver counselling and psychotherapeutic courses in Exeter, for Exeter University. It's called the Iron Mill. And we're setting up a centre where I will be using humour and doing psychotherapy through stand-up comedy workshops. Particularly, I want to do it with soldiers.
Oh.
Because I think that they have naturally a wonderful way of dealing with humour. They need their humour. It gives them that camaraderie, but it also gives them the ability to bring down the power of somebody. You know, sort of, and put people into perspective, and that's
also,
what
also they're dealing with trauma. You know, they're trauma victims essentially.
Totally, a lot
They've
of got, them.
They're
are.
Holding a lot of grief, perhaps.
Yeah, but this is some way that I think we could all deal if we understand that laughing and having the dark side of humour, allowing that, giving it permission. Mm. Let's say,
yeah,
as you have to, it's part of the therapeutic process.
And on that note, I was going to ask you about your School of Comedy workshop for homeless people as well. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's exactly the same in the same vein, because I think people are looking for a route to commit to in their lives, and if they can do it through stand-up comedy. Mm. We've got the vehicles, because there are various clubs you can join, basically, or just do stand-up in, and I think it can give you your route to success, whether it gives you the confidence to, like Jimmy Carr, to be a comedian or write for somebody. It doesn't matter who you are, but the fact that you can be taught to find your own comedic voice, which is what I did when I did my stand-up comedy. I did it within 6 weeks, and it was the most frightening thing I've ever done. But it was so amazing that I did it. And it taught me so much from a totally different perspective that I didn't expect. So I do encourage everybody to do it, but I do want more charities to actually focus on this type of thing, where it teaches people something. You get the camaraderie, you might find a gift somewhere else, but it is the gift that keeps on giving. It is. Yeah. It's never useless to learn how to be funny.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of charities that you are involved with is very, very impressive, and I can see that they're all very, very significant to you and close to your heart, and you're a mentor for many initiatives as well. What do you do in your downtime? I'll rephrase that. What do you watch in your downtime? Netflix or films?
Yeah, I watch a lot of trash.
Well, I suppose one can switch off.
Yeah, because, you know, I read quite heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And also, you know, when I have clients, I want to just go back to something a bit nothing, who cares type of thing. Mm. But I like a bit of humour. So, you know, I watch something like Mother, Father, Son. That's quite a
Which
good...
is an interesting combination of Helen McCrory and Richard Gere, isn't it? I never would have placed them as a couple.
No, but I adore her.
She is brilliant.
She is one of the most sensational actresses of our time.
Yeah.
And I'm so pleased that people are seeing her on, you know, sort of on TV and so on. And I think she's going to be, obviously she's big, but she'll be super big. Anything with Tom Hardy in it?
Oh, absolutely.
I think him in Legend was second to none, and I think he's totally underrated.
Yeah.
He should have been given a big, big prize for that. He was amazing.
I think his time's still to come. I think he's already shown what
he
can do.
Yeah, I love that side of him. Yeah. I do like Taboo. I think it could show a bit of lightness to the darkness. And I know he works on that with his dad, and I, you know, think he's a great, great talent. So, you know, things, either the actor will draw me to it. I did love A Star Is Born. I've seen all three. And I
was going to say, you know, which one were we talking about?
The last one, with Gaga and
Bradley Cooper.
Bradley.
And that was him making his directorial debut.
Yeah, but also his first announcement into the world of music.
Yeah.
And I'm also in music. I own Dingwall's music. And to see that they had this exchange of talents, in a way, he helped her with her acting and she helped him with his music. Mm. And I think that was an amazing combination. And you could see that. And in all three that Star Is Born, all the women are not classic beauties, but they have this handsomeness, as they used to say, but this immense talent. But he really comes across so well in that. And I've seen, I mean,
he
I
did
met him
do
once.
Well, considering it was the first one that he'd done, and his, as you say, entrance into music. And people, I think, were unsure when they first heard about the production of it. occurring. And then actually it was remarkably well received by the critics, wasn't it?
Because I think
they got some, you know,
yeah, and I think that rawness between them, that exchange of talent, was so powerful. And she stripped off her makeup and all her, you know, sort of the stuff
layers
that she wears,
yeah.
And you know, and she is a tour de force, no question, but so is he. And I think as a singer, he really showed himself well, and he's now, he's sprung himself directly into the world of music.
If you just met someone and you had to recommend something, and let's say they haven't seen anything, what film would it be?
Oh my goodness, this is tough. Shutter Island.
Oh, Shutter Island. So you're a Scorsese fan?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't think I'm a particular director fan. You know, Hitchcock was always interesting, but Shutter Island was so amazing and unexpected, and the twists and turns and the darkness.
Yeah.
You know, I think, yeah, get a grip with that. If you can create a film that keeps you on the edge, but also...
It's also psychologically
testing,
isn't it? Yeah,
because I love that. Because I know that the mind is so big. It's vast, you know, and that the film there, the, and the director and the acting just keeps you on your toes and you're never quite sure until the end. And then you go, oh, my God, that's how crazy we can be.
We are all a little bit
crazy. Hence, we love humour.
Maria, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us on In Real Life. We'll look out for this Candle After Comedy Club that you're about to create.
Oh no, Jules, it's always great to see you.